Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Across the UK, online and on DAB Digital Radio. Women's Football Weekly with Faye Carruthers on TalkSport 2. All the action, excitement and drama from across the entire women's game.
Feed off the line by Steph Horton.
Including the Women's Super League.
Emma Bright is there to tap in.
And the Euro 2021 qualifiers.
On the edge of the area to Emsley.
World-beating big match conversation.
There's Jodie Taylor.
On the station that's raising the game for women's football.
And she scores!
Women's Football Weekly with Faye Carruthers on TalkSport 2.
Hello, hello. Welcome to this Women's Football Weekly special. I'm Faye Carruthers. Thank you for keeping me company on this Monday evening. Still no live football, but still lots to talk about within the women's game. Tonight you'll hear from former Lioness Claire Rafferty, who's now the commercial manager at Chelsea, and Jen O'Neill, editor of She Kicks magazine. Between now and 7pm, we're talking about the growth of the women's game. Is it in a stronger place nationally and commercially? Have past changes been the right ones over the previous 10 years? And are the audiences really big enough, both here in the UK and abroad as well? There's a lot to cover, and as ever, I'd like to hear from all of you guys this evening too. What positive changes have you seen in women's football in the past 10 years? We're talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly, celebrating and questioning where women's football is at right now in May 2020. Join in, get involved, tell us what you think. Tweet us at TalkSport2.
Women's Football Weekly with Faye Carruthers.
Hi, I'm Ashley from Tottenham Hotspur, and you're listening to the Women's Football Weekly on TalkSport2.
So women's football has undoubtedly changed massively in the last 10 years, but has it been a defining decade for the women's game in terms of professionalism, sponsorship, development and growth? Now, to mull over this for the next hour are two experts of women's football, former England and Chelsea defender, now Lewis board member and commercial manager at Chelsea, Claire Rafferty, and the editor of She Kicks magazine and sometimes football summariser, Jen O'Neill. Just to confirm to all of you, we are socially distanced. Distancing, by the way. Each of us are in different parts of the UK and broadcasting via some amazing technology. Claire, lovely to hear from you. How are you doing?
Hello, good afternoon, Faye. How are you doing?
Very, very good, thanks. Jen, I've missed you.
Yeah, I'm a bit worried about how amazing my technology is. So if I go a bit wobbly, we'll see.
Sounding pretty amazing to me at the moment. Claire, you've been involved at every level of the game, obviously as an elite player, now involved in the commercial aspect and at board level as well. You also do a fair bit in the media, of course. It's a massive question to start off with, I know. But how has the game changed, particularly in the last 10 years, in your eyes?
How long do you have, Faye? Because
we've got an hour.
The answer to that is, you know, almost really difficult to measure, because when I started, probably 12 years ago, actually, as a the fact that I wasn't a professional, I think that that's a good place to start. But 12 years ago, it is almost unrecognisable to the landscape of the game now. You know what, when I was prepping for this conversation, I actually had so many milestones written down, and I thought, no, I can't be talking for that long about it.
Yeah, go on, throw some of them out there.
But you know what, so I think it kind of goes a little bit unappreciated. I think the Hope Powell era, and for me, Lioness, before they were Lionesses and we were just England women, the central contracts that were introduced, they're a big milestone in the way I see it. I think it actually removed the decision between being able to pay your mortgage and play for your country, which is actually laughable now when we look back. Mm. And I think that speaks volumes about how far we've come. I think Olympics was massive for actually realising the potential of the crowds that we could have. Obviously, we had 80,000 almost at Wembley for the Brazil game in the 2012 Olympics. So that was a massive milestone. And then, you know, the launch of the WSL in 2011, I think it was, wasn't it? Mm. And that investment from the FA, I know the FA get a bit criticism about it, but, you know, they actually have invested a lot of money in women's football. And I think the infrastructure around it going full time, you know, and then leading into that, the success of the 2015 World Cup, getting that bronze medal, Hope then leaving and Mark coming on board and implementing a different ethos. I just think the growing digital platform that England and the WSL and the leagues have really capitalised on. That's the positive stuff. I won't even get into the negatives. I'll leave Jen for that.
Well, okay then, Jen. There you go. The gauntlet's been laid down by Claire Rafferty. You're obviously editor of She Kicks magazine. That started back in 1996. On the Ball, was that what it was called then?
Yeah, so I joined them in 1998. I just left university at 96. I'm quite old, me.
No, you're not. Don't be silly. Yeah,
20 odd years we've sort of survived trying to promote and support the women's game and carried on in print and all that time. But early days, we had to do everything because people just did not know what was happening. You know, they didn't know. We were where they came for fixtures and results and how to find a team. That's just unimaginable that people wouldn't know those things now because of the visibility of the sport is so much improved. And Claire's made my job much easier because I was just ticking off. She mentioned that. Myself and a colleague, Catherine Ito, cried in 2012 at Wembley before that Team GB Brazil game as we saw all the crowds coming up, yeah. Olympic way it was called for that occasion. And so we see, I mean, that's not even that weird an occurrence now. It's almost like, oh, yeah, what, there's like 40, 50, 60,000 people at Wembley for a women's game now? Yes, we've seen that before, nothing to get too excited about. So there are so many mind-blowing developments in that 10-year period, and Claire's right, the FAWSL, particularly from an English perspective. And Hope I was instrumental in pushing for that as well. And it was delayed by a year. It was meant to come in 2010, but because of the financial instability, it was delayed a year, which is kind of a poignant given the sort of situation we're in at the moment.
Yeah, it certainly is.
That was massive, FAWSL. But from a personal point of view, in the 90s and the 90s, there were only a handful of people that covered the women's game from a sort of media perspective. And maybe you get some.
I think handful is complimentary. I think it was just you. Yeah.
Well, and Tony Layton and one or two others. And people would cover tournament or maybe be interested for a season and then they would get moved on. And in the past 10 years, there's been so many new, passionate, knowledgeable and fantastic journalists come onto the scene and ex-players. That's been key as well. People like yourself, Claire, who've come through playing the game and then have stepped into the media side. So the coverage is so much better. And that's not just the people, that's also the outlets. So a broadcast, online, you can watch football, women's games from around the world if you go online and you find them. And the FA player has been a game changer for me. Every WSL game live all season. We're just in such a totally different place than we were before.
Yeah, and Talk Sport 2 has its own weekly dedicated women's football show, of course, which, you know, would have been absolutely unheard of, even perhaps just a year to 2 years ago. And we're still the only national commercial radio station with a dedicated women's football show. National station, not even commercial. That's here every single week, which, you know, is brilliant. And we're bringing women's football to a whole new audience who perhaps before last summer's World Cup weren't really, they didn't have women's football on their radar, or they had a preconceived conception of what it was. And that's been changed. And there's been a lot of hard work done with that. And, you know, Jen, to be honest, massive kudos to you as well in a completely non-patronising way, because On the Ball as well was the first dedicated women's football magazine in England as well. And, you know, you've been writing for a very niche audience for quite a long time. Do you feel as if that's less niche now?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I love nothing more than getting up on a Sunday, not having to travel anywhere, picking up my tablet and reading what everybody else has written, then watching a couple of games and listening to podcasts and people talking about a sport that I can appreciate now as a fan almost, rather than as somebody who had to play a Premier League game, be absolutely battered by Arsenal, then have to ring around for results and write a report for the Times for the Monday morning. It's not niche anymore. It feels more like a mainstream sport, and the knowledge of fans has definitely improved because of social media. I think that's been key. But if we want to mention negatives, and kind of this is
we
I
have to.
The crux of this programme will end up being about finances and about money. And a caveat, I'm not a fan of money in football. I think it's ruined a lot of things, particularly in the men's game. So not all of the financial developments have been positive, and the way that the WSL has had to reimagine itself three times, or its first when it was first introduced, it's almost emphasised resources over ability of a team or a club. Yeah. And that's collateral damage. And we've accepted that because we want the sport to move on. But there's been a lot of negative sort of, I think fans have been upset by that. Players have been upset by that. Sorry, Claire.
No, sorry. I was going to say it's interesting hearing your side of it, because I was very much a player at that time and you don't have that viewpoint on it. So only now, stepping away, do I have a totally different viewpoint on the landscape of it, and listening to what you just said is really interesting.
It would be interesting for our listeners who perhaps are new to women's football, or have certainly only really embraced women's football since 2019, perhaps with the success of the Lionesses out in France at the World Cup. When you say collateral damage, Jen, do you want to tell people that the kind of clubs that were huge in the women's game a few years ago who've unfortunately had to fall by the wayside?
I mean, it happened in the 2000s. Initially, Fulham were the first team to ever go professional. Mohamed Al-Fayed put millions into his team. Players like Rachel Yankee, big stars at the time, played for that club. And in that era, it was kind of accepted that things would come and go because it was a whim of chairman. So Fulham and Charlton Athletic were big names in that era, and Southampton as well. Were funded and then weren't funded. My club, Sunderland, were funded, then weren't funded. We thought that when the game went to the next level, because that's what we were expecting the Super League to be, it was the game taken to the next level. Well, clubs like Sunderland fell by the wayside. Yeovil Town are another club over the last few years who have put everything into trying to become a community club and have fallen by the wayside. There are clubs that were in the WSL who couldn't afford to go into the professional era, like Oxford United, like Watford. We can list many teams that have been impacted down the pyramid. There are very ambitious clubs trying to work their way up. So that it's not entirely negative, but it leaves a bit of taste in some clubs.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it does. And I know you're not a fan of money, Jen, but unfortunately we've got so much to talk about. And one of the big influencing factors in the game is money. We're going to be hearing next from someone who can tell it like it is financially. Kieran Maguire from The Price of Football will be with you shortly. Let's find out just how much the women's game is worth. Has its value gone up, perhaps, or maybe even down? And of course, how will the current COVID-19 situation impact it? This is Women's Football Weekly on TalkSport 2 with me, Faye Carruthers, former Lioness Claire Rafferty, and She Kicks magazine editor Jen O'Neill. Remember, I want to hear from you. Tweet us your opinions or any questions at TalkSport 2 on Twitter. Now, how much is the WSL worth? Have a think before we come back. Is it A, 8 million, B, 15 million, C, 25 million? Find out after this.
Women's Football Weekly with Faye Carruthers.
Hi, I'm Jordan Nobbs, and you're listening to Women's Football Weekly on TalkSport 2.
A very, very good evening to you. This is Women's Football Weekly on TalkSport 2 with me, Faye Carruthers, and it's a very special edition this week where we're discussing the growth of women's football. With you is the editor of She Kicks magazine, Jen O'Neill, and former Chelsea she is still the Chelsea commercial manager and Lewis board member as well, Claire Rafferty. Right, we need to talk money, don't we? To help us do just that is the author of Price of Football, Kieran Maguire. Thanks for joining us, Kieran.
Thanks very much, Faye.
So the question that I posed to our lovely listeners earlier on was, what is the WSL worth? We gave them three options: A, 8 million, B, 15 million, C, 25 million. So which figure are we talking?
I think we're talking B in terms of WSL revenues. That varies very much from club to club. So we've got clubs such as Brighton and Reading who are making around about £250,000 each. And then we move up to Manchester City at 2 million and Chelsea at 3.5. So it's a bit like the Premier League itself, in the sense that there's a big divide between individual clubs, and clearly at the lower levels there's a challenge to grow those revenues, but everything's heading in a positive direction until coronavirus hit us.
Yeah, we'll talk about COVID-19 shortly, but you know, financially, would you say £15 million, is that a good place? You know, obviously we're used to talking big Premier League money in ludicrous terms. £15 million for the WSL, is that healthy?
It's healthy if you're making a profit from it, and sort of the downside, and I think we have to remember that effectively the WSL is a startup business, and you expect startups to lose money. So the WSL clubs lost around about £6 million last season. They are being subsidised by the parent clubs. But you know, those losses are to be expected. If you want to attract talent to the game, you've got to go and pay people appropriate wages. And also you're going to be spending money on marketing and advertising and trying to develop the audience and to get people interested in not only watching the game when it's being broadcast, but clearly physically attending matches as well.
Yeah. In the past 10 years, in terms of finance, we're obviously talking about the growth of women's football, particularly over the last decade. What are your biggest findings?
I think what we are seeing is that getting sponsors has been critical in terms of growing the game. The fact that Barclays have gone in for this, you know, this long-term multi-million-pound WSL sponsorship, I think is absolutely critical, because I think that shows that national and international companies are finding that there is value in the women's game. And I think once you get one of those large multinationals coming along, then others will follow. So it will help the individual clubs, the directors of those clubs, the people who are involved in the marketing departments. They'll now be able to go out and say to potential sponsors, look, Barclays are sponsoring the league as a whole. They're a blue chip company. Fancy coming along and getting involved, because you're going to suffer reputational gains on the back of that.
Yeah, Claire Rafferty, obviously you're commercial manager at Chelsea.
I was just about to jump in then.
Yeah, you go for it. What were you going to ask?
Yeah, I've got so many questions for you, Kieran. We'll take this offline after. But I think for me, what I've seen such a big gap in the actual, you know, the brand of the Lionesses and how well that's been commercialised, and then the brand of the WSL and how that hasn't been commercialised as well. Obviously, individual clubs, it's a totally different audience, which is what we found at Chelsea. How do you kind of actually get your numbers? And because what we found is there's actually just quite a lack of data. It's difficult to set a benchmark as to, you know, what commercially we were expected in for some of our partnerships.
I agree with you that it is a challenge. I mean, the Lionesses have been a fantastic brand, and I think one of the things which attracts people so much to the national team, and certainly this is also true of the US women's national team, and perhaps another analogy would be the England cricket team as well, is that the national support base seems far more motivated and far more activated than it does on a local level. If the money which is being generated by the Lionesses can start to drop down to a greater extent to the individual clubs, and also I think if a WSL club won the Champions League in Europe, all of a sudden there would be greater interest. My observation is also that we are now getting more and more local derbies. So you must know that if you are hosting Arsenal or Spurs during the season, you'll be able to sell far more packages to individual match day sponsors because people know that the crowds are going to be there. And if you are looking at it from a commercial point of view, you know, rightly or wrongly, a commercial partner or somebody that wants a hospitality package wants to be part of a big crowd. Now, you're going to achieve that if you've got Everton versus Liverpool, if you've got United versus City, and we've now got the, you know, three senior London clubs involved as well. And, of course, there's West Ham to take into consideration.
Kieran, how important do you feel the next broadcast deal is for the WSL, away from the Lionesses, for the actual the clubs, the lower league clubs and the WSL too as well? How important do you feel that deal is?
I think it's more important from a profile point of view than a financial. If people see a good product on television, then they'll be more inclined to watch the match. So I would be looking to have more matches covered, better highlights packages and things of that nature than actually the top line in terms of revenue that's being generated. Fans will watch football because they love football. If there is a slot being filled by the WSL, then I think that will attract a bigger audience in terms of match day. And ultimately, that's going to be the benchmark of success for the WSL, because getting crowds in and keeping them is a way of then generating more commercial relationships. And also, the broadcasters themselves, as they see the attendances start to increase, they'll be more inclined to come up with more money for the next deal. So to a certain extent, I would sort of follow the approach that was taken by the Premier League itself when it started to sell overseas packages. It effectively gave them away for nothing in the early years of the Premier League to build up interest in the game and to develop the audience. So that would be my view in terms of direction of travel.
It's really interesting you say that, Kieran, because of course there are lots of other factors, but they all kind of merge together, don't they? That, you know, it's almost like a jigsaw puzzle and they all need to come together in order for improvements to be made. You've mentioned attendances being up in the top tiers. I know that's obviously going to then affect things from a commercial point of view, but also how does it affect clubs' match day income and how useful is that?
Well, the match day income figures that I've seen, and very few clubs are putting them out, which is always a little bit of a cause for concern, because you wonder, well, why are they so reluctant to show the information? If we take a club such as Birmingham, it had match day income in 2019 of just £22,000. Now, that's for a club that had a turnover of just over £1 million. So, yeah, it was 2%. What is Birmingham trying to do? It's effectively trying to use promotions and things of that nature as a loss leader. Manchester United had the highest match day income at £127,000, which you know is clearly good to be getting into those six figure regimes. But you know, that is Manchester United and everything that goes along with that club in terms of being a global brand. So you'd expect United to be at the top end of the tier. It's that balancing act, as you correctly said. You want to build the audiences, but you want to build the revenues as well. So trying to get the right price point is a real challenge for the people that are selling the game to potential viewers and fans.
Yeah, and that is something we saw when we were talking about the London Derby earlier on in the season. Of course, Chelsea at the beginning of the season made the choice to give away free tickets effectively by contacting fans. And, you know, that can work in good ways and bad ways. Interestingly, I just want to put a stat out there which I thought was very interesting, and it would be fascinating to see what it is now in 2020, because a report from Nielsen Sport, who conducted research into eight different countries, basically found sponsorship deals in the women's game have increased by 37% between 2013 and 2017. So you would expect, bearing in mind the growth of the game, particularly in the last 2 to 3 years, that figure would be even higher. Jen, just finally, you've seen the growth in coverage from a media point of view, but does that growth, in your opinion, tie in with a financial growth in the game as well?
Well, certainly from the perspective of brands coming on board, as Kieran's already mentioned, Barclays' 3-year deal, you have Visa on board as a separate sponsor of the women's game at European UEFA level, Boots, Continental, all these big names. They're there because the visibility and the coverage, it makes it attractive. The professionalisation of the sport improves the product. It makes competition better. And that in turn drives investment. And so it's always been a case of sponsorship and revenue coming hand in hand. That's in terms of sponsorship. It's always going to be difficult. I think the next piece in the jigsaw is to get the bums on seats and to increase attendances, because I think all of the signs are that TV audiences are there if you provide the coverage. And one area I know that broadcasters are slightly concerned about is finding a place in a competitive week in terms of football viewership when to place the women's game. It doesn't have a natural home, and they're campaigning for 3 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon, which is obviously sacrosanct in England and in Scotland to not play at that time or not broadcast it a game at that time. But that's where they're hoping to be able to put it in the future. But yeah, it's the two things are totally linked. I think even, you know, newspapers and broadcasters are seeing that there's a huge potential there. If you cover women's sport, not just women's football, then you will get readership and get viewership.
That word potential comes up a lot, doesn't it? And sometimes that potential, you just feel it's got to start to become realised at some point, which it is being, but I feel like it needs more of a nudge. And that's what we're here for on Women's Football Weekly on Talk Sport 2. Lots more to discuss. I'm Faye Carruthers alongside Claire Rafferty, She Kicks editor Jen O'Neill, and the Price of Football author Kieran Maguire. It is now 6:30 coming up. Did the 2019 Women's World Cup inspire more people to get involved in football? We'll find out.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Next.
Women's Football Weekly with Faye Carruthers.
It was a goal that set her career alight.
On TalkSport 2.
You are listening to Women's Football Weekly on TalkSport 2 with me, Faye Carruthers. Today we're asking you, what positive changes have you seen in women's football in the past 10 years? Derek has messaged in. He said, for me, more fans coming to the games, know a lot more players, and broadcasting live games are more popular on TV and the FA Player. Sam says the investment from the FA, the move to Wembley for the FA Cup finals while keeping ticket prices fair and value for money for women's football and the safe environment for fans. Keep them coming. Tweet us at TalkSport2 or use the hashtag TSWFW. Former Chelsea, West Ham and England defender, now Chelsea's commercial manager, Claire Rafferty is with you, along with the editor of She Kicks magazine, Jen O'Neill, and our expert in finances, Kieran Maguire, author of The Price of Football. Now, when we look back at the growth of the women's game, we kind of can't do that without looking down the leagues. As I'm sure you know, Claire, it used to be quite difficult to get into women's teams. There weren't that many around. The women's game wasn't set up like the men's with academies and things. Yeah. But now kids are able to join a club as young as 4 and then progress through the ranks. You can see that at clubs like Manchester City. How important has it been for clubs to set up academies, almost getting their own house in order, if you like, by setting up some kind of proper structure. And have you seen that at Chelsea?
Yeah, you know what, actually, I didn't have a great deal of knowledge in how the academy system worked. I know they've been working on it behind the scenes. I've actually reached out to one of the head coaches in the academy, TJ, who's given me a bit of an insight. Just because there's not a lot of visibility on it if you're not actually involved in it.
That's a big problem.
we have... Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think the fact that I didn't even know in the first place might highlight the issue. But actually, the structure of the academy has improved and is actually, I can only ever speak for Chelsea's behalf, but, we have under 10s, under 12s, 14s, 16s, all the way up to 18s. The 14s and 16s obviously play, the regional girls academy league against the southern-based clubs, like Arsenal, Southampton. And the under 18s play in the National League against all the other WSL clubs and some Championship clubs, I think, as well. And I think, as you said, it's very important to actually get your house in order. We've had a free, I think, graduate from the academy scheme now.
And we've seen how crucial that is in the men's game. Obviously, funding is a problem. Kieran, from your findings, how many clubs actually have the profit to build their own academies and stadiums? Because, of course, it always does come down to money, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, the clubs are almost universally losing money, but... their host clubs, the men's teams to which they're associated, if the women's club loses money, that's excluded from financial fair play calculations. So there is an incentive to invest in the women's teams and also the academies, because that widens the talent net. And also it means that further down the line, you're not going to have to pay out transfer fees when you are recruiting. So the women's game, unfortunately, isn't making money, even at the WSL top tier level. But I'm not particularly surprised by that, because if you want to attract players, you have to pay them appropriate wages. And whilst the game's not generating enough money at present, if the players are good to attract new punters to come and watch the game, then those figures can potentially turn around.
Jen O'Neill from She Kicks magazine, do you think it's really important that the money clubs need to be investing in this? They should try and have this kind of one club set up, and that's where the money needs to be directed to?
Yeah, but I think they're two different things, because the FA have had a talent pathway in place since the late 90s. Kelly Simmons was integral in putting that into place. So 30-odd clubs throughout the last 20 years, the minimum of 30, sometimes it's been 40, 50 clubs have had centres of excellence, and now we have regional talent centres, or there's special development centres, and they feed into national performance camps, and that's where they've unearthed a lot of this talent, and they do partly fund that for clubs across the country. So it's not just down to the men's club to fund that, although when it gets to academy level, so over 16, then I do believe that the onus is slightly more on the club itself. And we have seen some fantastic players coming through that, and we have over many years. And the England team is pretty much, full of players who've come through that system, through that pathway. The one club ethos, absolutely, is, I think, even for... because not every club can afford to fund their women's team to the extent that a Chelsea or a Manchester United or an Arsenal can... it's a mindset, it's an attitude and a habit to have, to include your women's team, your women's players, when you market new kit launches or, in imagery and information on your website or around the stadium, sharing information about fixtures or trials. It's an attitude to have, that everybody within the club should have respect and be inclusive. It doesn't always cost money, and that's what's always frustrated me about certain clubs, and even to an extent association and federation level or county FAs, that they don't give the women's or the youth or the disability or any other area of the sport the coverage and visibility that they could have, which doesn't cost money.
Yeah, you make a really interesting point there, because it's something that you can see the success. Success can be measured when you see the one club mentality. The successful clubs are the ones that have adopted it in recent times, and it's quite important. You are listening to Women's Football Weekly on Talk Sport 2 with me, Faker Ruthers. I'm alongside Claire Rafferty, Jen O'Neill and Kieran Maguire. I just want to throw some figures at you all because the FA released figures at the end of 2019 revealing that 2.63 million women aged 16 and over in England now play football, which is up 9% from 3 years ago. So participation figures have risen across different adult age groups with almost 350,000 new players compared with this time last year. We're talking specifically about the growth of women's football, particularly over the last decade as well. Claire, how much do you think that has been a result of big tournaments like last year's World Cup?
Yeah, I think that's a paramount reason for. I think it's a massive catalyst for actually young girls, you know, choosing to play football and also choosing to ask a question if they can't, why can't I? I remember I asked that question when I was younger. You know, why do I have to stop playing with the boys? Why don't I have a team? So I think that the more you see it, the more you can be. So I think that's been a massive influence. Also, obviously, you know, the social media side of things has been key. And the storytelling and the narrative just behind the players, you know, they're all relatable, you know, just normal women. I never had that role model and that kind of expectation to be a professional footballer, and these young girls, you know, they do now. So I think it is, the Lionesses have been key, but I think also obviously the WSL and the league has played an important role.
Yeah, similar findings from UEFA as well. Their research showed that the number of youth leagues, so we're talking under six teams to under 23s, has grown from 164 in 2013 to 266 in 2017. So that's an additional 102 leagues, like leagues, in the space of 4 years, which is...
I think it's actually just about the talent pool that we have. You know, the more options and more, you know, availability of players, it's only going to strengthen the league. It's only going to strengthen the national team. So I think that is key to success, and I've always stood by that.
Mm. It's not just more people playing women's football, more people are watching it as well. During the 2011 World Cup in Germany, a peak match average viewing figure of 1.7 million was reached. In 2019, we all know the figures, a massive 11.7 million people watching England's defeat by the USA in the semi-final of the World Cup. I mean, that's growth of 10 million. We've talked about broadcasting a little bit, but Jen O'Neill from She Kicks magazine, do you think broadcasters also have to play a part in this and make games available to watch on free-to-air TV?
Yeah, absolutely. And your figures pretty much just explained that in stark reality. And I was commentating for Eurosport in 2011. Well, how many people have Eurosport? With the best will in the world, they didn't have the player that you could watch online. And so as soon as the BBC obviously were involved at a certain level, so 2009 even, the BBC only showed the Euro semi-final and final when the women got to the final in Finland. It has to be visible. It is so crucial. And, you know, all these hundreds of thousands of little girls and boys who want to be just like Lucy Bronze, for example, because they saw her score wonder goals in 2015 or 2019, they wouldn't even know who she was if it wasn't for free-to-air broadcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Kieran, I just want to leave one final point to you. Kieran Maguire from The Price of Football, you're hearing the thoughts from. In terms of, we are going to do a special Women's Football Weekly on the future of women's football next week. But from your point of view, in terms of the future growth of the game financially, are we on an upward trajectory, and how... steep is that incline?
I think we have been on a upward trajectory. If you just got to look at the accounts of Everton, you know, their income's gone up by around about 30% this year. And I know some of the people. I work in Liverpool, so I know how much people were looking forward to the match against Liverpool and Manchester United and so on. I genuinely am now worried about the impact of the coronavirus because of the overall hit that it's going to take to the game. And therefore, with women's teams losing money, Are the parent clubs going to be willing to invest the additional monies that would have been otherwise required to keep up that upward push in terms of developing the game and generating further interest?
Anecdotally, are you hearing anything that could be to the detriment of women's teams in the future?
My concern is that clubs are looking on a line-by-line basis at all expenses of the clubs and looking to see where they can make cuts. So there is no reason why the women's game should be exempt from the nature of those reviews which are taking place.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kieran Maguire from The Price of Football. Your thoughts and expertise, much appreciated. You are listening to a Women's Football Weekly special. I'm Faker Ruthers, and I'm alongside Claire Rafferty and Jen O'Neill. Social distancing alongside. I use alongside in the loosest term. Don't forget, Women's Football Weekly is actually now available on podcast as well. So if you do miss anything, you can download on Spotify and iTunes and listen back to us whenever and wherever you like. Next up, we're going to round up everything and debate what the game needs to do going forward.
Across the UK, online and on DAB Digital Radio.
Hi, I'm Gemma Bonner and you're listening to Women's Football Weekly on TalkSport 2.
A very good evening to you. It's Monday evening and this is Women's Football Weekly on TalkSport 2 with me, Faker Ruthers. Claire Rafferty and Jen O'Neill are still with us. They're broadcasting from their homes, of course. So far, we've been focusing on the growth in the UK, but of course, we do need to look beyond that. And we couldn't have a show here on TalkSport 2 without talking about the big news that came out of the United States on Friday. The US women's team have been at the forefront of the women's game. Four-time World Cup winners and, of course, campaigners for equal pay. So before we look at the infrastructure over there and what we can learn from that here in the UK, we need to focus on that news regarding USWNT's legal battle with US soccer, as this is obviously key to the growth of the game globally. Jen O'Neill, editor of She Kicks magazine, I know you've also been following this story closely. Can you just summarise for people what's been going on?
Well, I shall try to. I'm not a legal expert.
And
either,
it's very complex, I know.
It is. So basically, led by players like Alex Morgan and Megan Rapinoe, the US women's national team last March filed a lawsuit against US soccer, the federation. And their complaint was for violations around equal pay and unfair treatment. They were saying that basically the men were getting paid more than them and they were getting better travel and accommodation. They were quite confident they were going to win. So when on Friday, the US district judge threw out their equal pay claim, they were shocked and disappointed. He said that because they turned down a collective bargaining agreement, which was offered to them and to the men's team, because they didn't agree with it in the first instance, they can't now say that they missed out on earnings that they would have got. That's kind of his argument. However, he has upheld their complaint that there's a gross disparity in the money spent on airfare and hotels, etc., for the men's team compared to the women's team.
That's kind of where we are. It does very much sound like they're going to end up settling out of court, which is what everybody expected them to do anyway. But what I found fascinating about it was that the judge seemed to suggest that the women's team were victims of their own success because they had got millions in bonuses for being successful, whereas the men's team had only qualified, hadn't qualified for the World Cup in 2018. And in order to get a bonus, they needed to have qualified for two World Cups. They didn't. So it actually works out that the women's team earned more money than the men's team. And that's why he threw it out. But actually, if the men's team had qualified for two tournaments in a row, they would have been given bonuses that would have vastly diminished what the women's team had won in bonuses. So, I mean, that to me personally, you know, it defeated the object and was very difficult for the women's team to fight back on.
Yeah, fundamentally, the women's team at this present time and in the last few years has been more successful. They've been more profitable. They've had higher TV audiences than the men's team. So their argument is fairly sound. And they are quite confident that if they go to appeal, which they're going to do, they will be successful in the long term. And Becky Sauerbrunn, the defender and sometime co-captain, had tweeted, "If you know this team at all, you will know we have a lot of fight left in us. We knew this wasn't going to be easy. Change never is." So they're not backing down, and it could mean that the trial gets put over to 2021.
Well, they are appealing it, actually. I saw something flash up on my screen not that long ago saying that they will appeal, which we expected.
And it's very important, I think, more so the treatment aspect, the gender discrimination in terms of how much the Federation were paying to fly the men's team to tournaments. They needed to be better rested, apparently, which seems a crazy argument. This will have more of an impact for other women's teams around the world than necessarily the equal pay thing will, because the US women's team have a much stronger argument in terms of equal pay, and it clouds the argument for other national teams and other female players around the world, because Joe Bloggs down the street thinks that all women are demanding to be paid the same as, for example, Lionel Messi, which they're not, but they want the respect. It doesn't cost that much to give respect. And federations and associations should be setting the example of fair treatment, especially when you consider in England, the FA banned the women's game for 50 odd years and put the development of the sport back.
Back. And of course, the whole point of this Women's Football Weekly special is talking about the growth of women's football. And this is going to massively help the growth of women's football, because they have put this argument and this situation on a global stage. It's being talked about by a lot of people. And actually, something like this, perhaps, you know, 20 years ago or 10 years ago, which is the time frame that we're discussing at the moment, just wouldn't have happened, or certainly wouldn't have had as much exposure in the media as this has.
Oh, absolutely. And being in the stadium when Infantino came out and in Lyon for the World Cup final, and you've got an entire crowd chanting equal pay, they really are making their mark. And Megan Rapinoe, as a person, as a spokesperson, they're making people think anyway, and making people think about acceptance. And that's got to be a massive thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Claire Rafferty, you're now a board member at Lewis FC. Conversations like this, how important are they?
You know, linking back to the USA point, it's about actually setting standards and not being bullied into settling for anything less. You know, Lewis has set a benchmark in this country for, you know, equal pay, and the Equality FC that they stand for. I think we have to think about sometimes how clubs are actually set up, and I think Lewis are leading in that front. I think, you know, we all look up to the USA team, and I think Jen actually explained it really well, because I've been quite confused about what's been going on. And even, you know, internationally, lots of times in training, I remember at Chelsea, all different nationalities, Swedish team, Danish, Dutch, for example, we all come together and we have these debates in the changing room, and we'd be like, well actually, then we're going to ask our federation for this, and, you know, we're going to, well, that's good to know, we're going to then ask our federation. So this, what the USA are doing and what Lewis are doing, it is paramount to making change in women's football and women's sport.
Yeah, and that's crucial. Look, finally, before we go, I'm going to have to ask you each the quickest question with the quickest response. Claire, first of all, we've been discussing the growth of the women's game throughout this past hour in the past 10 years. Do you think the women's game is going to grow as much in the next 10 years?
Yes. Done.
Boom. Jen?
I have to mention Doncaster Bells as a casualty, otherwise people will shoot me. They had their 52nd anniversary this year. And they were a team that were crucial in the development of the women's game, and they were a casualty of WSL. Anyway, yes, absolutely, it's going to grow as much. And it will be more visible and more tangible, because we've reached the tipping point. FIFA, UEFA, national associations and media and the brands are all catching on board to that key word, that the potential of the women's game.
Yeah, that word is key, potential. It's safe to say everyone's optimistic about the future of the women's game. Still a long way to go. And so much to do and to fight for as well. And that's exactly what we're going to be focusing on as we bring you another Women's Football Weekly special here on TalkSport 2 next week about the future of the game. What can we do to bring women's football to the masses? It's been an absolute pleasure discussing the growth of the women's game so far with former Lioness, of course, former West Ham, Chelsea, and England defender Claire Rafferty. Jen O'Neill, editor of She Kicks magazine as well. Thank you so much. And many thanks to the Price of Football author Kieran Maguire as well. Don't forget, please spread the word. Subscribe to the Women's Football Weekly podcast as well. It's available to download on iTunes and Spotify.
Across the UK, online and on DAB Digital Radio, Women's Football Weekly
on TalkSport 2.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.